of the Christian faith anywhere, but the gaze of the Emperor, unblinking and all-seeing, would be upon it. True, there was an element of bluff in this eyeballing of the rabbis. Justinian, who had thought nothing of driving the philosophers of Athens into exile, had no corresponding intention to force the closure of the schools of Tiberius. In fact, to a large degree, they served his purpose. The rabbis offered to the emperor a living assurance that there did authentically exist a religion such as Judaism, one with authority figures and a clearly defined orthodoxy, the mirror image of his own. The alternative, to acknowledge that in the great ocean of belief there might still be those who swam untrammelled beyond the twin dragnets of Christianity and Judaism, was infinitely more unsettling. The rabbis themselves would probably not have disagreed. After all, it was hardly unflattering to their pretensions to imagine a world in which there were Jews and Christians and no one else. It was telling, perhaps, that the watchtowers built on Mount Berenice were not confined to its summit. Although the presence of the great church clearly established where the supremacy lay, Justinian did not neglect to offer his protection to the Jews as well. The fortifications ran right down the slope of the mountain and enclosed the entire city. The Jews may have been second-class subjects, but they were at least within the fold. There remained others, however, who were harder to sort. Not everyone who trod the sacred dust of the Holy Land could be categorized neatly as a Christian or a Jew. Much though both emperors and rabbis might have wished it otherwise, Palestine was simply too God-haunted, too dream-crowded, too memory-stalked for that. Right in the heart of the province, for instance, there was a people who openly derided both Christian churches and Jewish synagogues as abodes of idolatry, and all those who worshipped in them as upstarts. The Samaritans, inhabitants of a region midway between Jerusalem and Galilee, named Samaria, claimed that they, and they alone, had preserved the unadorned wishes of heaven. "There is no God but one," they declared. "Let us believe in him and in Moses, his prophet." From these simple presumptions, so it seemed to the Samaritans, much else inevitably flowed. All the scriptures penned since the time of Moses, whether by Jews or Christians, were mere deluded vanity. The purity of the teachings that God revealed to his prophet had been corrupted by any number of subsequent accretions. Jerusalem, far from being a holy city, had been promoted as such by David and Solomon for purely political reasons. In truth, it was neither the Temple Mount nor the Rock of Golgotha that constituted the centre of the world, but rather a wooded peak in Samaria, Mount Gerizim. It was here, on a flat expanse of rock named the Eternal Hill by the Samaritans, that Noah's Ark had landed. Abraham had prepared to sacrifice Isaac, and the laws given to Moses had been preserved. To believe any differently, as the Jews and the Christians did, was to distort the primal teachings that God had revealed to the ancient prophets. It was to neglect the principal duty of humanity, due submission to God. None of which, needless to say, did much for the Samaritans' popularity with their neighbours. Jewish scorn for their pretensions ran particularly deep. For centuries, in a blatantly tit-for-tat manner, the rabbis had accused the Samaritans themselves of being the idolaters. This on the supposed grounds that they were descended from pagans and worshipped a dove. As a result, far from embracing them as potential allies, most Jews refused even to sit down with them, let alone consume their wine or food, although the odd rabbi was prepared to grant that it might be legitimate to tuck into one of their boiled eggs. As for Christians, the sanctions they applied would prove in the long run to be of an altogether more forceful order of brutality, an exercise in state-sponsored violence bred of wholly predictable tensions. Despite the fact that the Samaritans were permitted to serve in the Roman army, and indeed had long enjoyed an impressive reputation among their commanders for martial savagery, Christian relic hunters had still ransacked Mount Gerizim, and Christian colonists had still flooded into Samaria. In 484, Samaritan patience had finally snapped. A bishop had been mutilated in his own cathedral. Churches had been desecrated. Open rebellion had blazed right across central Palestine. The provincial authorities, although initially taken by surprise, had been ruthless in crushing the revolt. Samaria had been left littered with some 10,000 corpses. All Samaritans, unsurprisingly, had been demobbed from imperial service for good. The crowning act of vengeance, however, had been to ban them from the sacred slopes of Mount Gerizim, and to build on its previously unadorned summit a church within a fortress. And on the church, as one Samaritan historian would bitterly record, there was constructed a very high tower, which was painted white, and from which lamps were hung to glow in the night, so that all in Constantinople and Rome might see them. There was, of course, as any Jew could have pointed out, nothing particularly groundbreaking about this display of imperial vindictiveness. The Samaritans, however, had not had 400 years to adjust to the loss of their holiest sanctuary, nor could they quite bring themselves to believe that God would permit its continued desecration. Desperation and rage duly festered. A few decades on from the Great Revolt, when a small band of Samaritan insurgents, prompted by the suggestion of a woman, sought to seize back the summit of Mount Gerizim from its Christian garrison, the incipient rebellion was quarantined only with difficulty. And, in 529, when rioting saw a number of Jews and Christians killed by a mob of Samaritans, the spark proved sufficient to light a second conflagration. For a brief while, it seemed as though not only Palestine, but the whole empire might be cut in two. For a warlord, who shared with the long-dead pagan emperor the sinister name of Julian, a man variously described as a king, a messiah, or a bandit chief, proclaimed the foundation of a Samaritan empire, blocking the roads from the north and menacing Jerusalem. Adding yet further spice to the rebellion, the insurgents staged a number of highly pointed atrocities, of which, the most spectacular, was the incineration of a bishop on a bonfire fueled by the relics of Christian martyrs. Insults such as these, of course, might almost have been calculated to provoke a devastating response. The imperial vengeance, when it finally came, was inevitably a terrible one. The rebel army, brought to battle, was annihilated with such efficiency that 20,000 Samaritan warriors were left dead, including a summarily decapitated Julian. New, more impregnable fortifications were raised around the summit of the Eternal Hill, and the slopes of Mount Gerizim scoured clean of every last trace of a Samaritan presence. Meanwhile, across the rest of Samaria, the ruin was universal. Land that had once been hailed as the most fertile in the world was now a wilderness of carrion, rubble, and weeds. As for the Samaritans themselves, there seemed nothing left to them but despair. Many, abandoning the God who had so transparently failed them, sullenly submitted to baptism. Others, slumping into a numb isolationism, hunkered down in remote villages, where they ostentatiously covered any footprints left by visiting Jews or Christians with burning straw. Yet others, however, tried to keep the banner of rebellion flying, not by making a stand in Samaria, but by retreating beyond the border. As many as 50,000 of them, fleeing the reprisals of Justinian's death squads, made a break for Mesopotamia, where they threw themselves on the mercy of the aged Kharvad. The Shahanshah, rather than swallow the assurances of the Samaritans that they could deliver him Palestine, opted instead to put them all in chains and pack them off to toil in a gold mine. Nevertheless, back in Palestine itself, the Roman authorities remained twitchy in the extreme at any prospect of a Samaritan retrenchment just over the border. In the wake of the revolt, when 20,000 Samaritan boys and girls were handed over to slavers, it was specifically decreed that they must be sold as far afield as possible, preferably in Persia or India. The prospect that any of them might grow up within striking distance of their homeland was altogether too alarming to be tolerated. There was more to this anxiety than mere paranoia. Notwithstanding the milk and honey that flowed through the Holy Land, it bordered directly onto wilderness, and wilderness, as it had ever done, spelled danger. Right on the doorstep of Jerusalem, along the 15-mile road that led eastwards to Jericho, menace lurked behind every barren rock, so that what had long since come to be named the Bloody Way was as notorious for banditry as anywhere in the empire. South of Jericho, where steepling cliffs plunged down towards the aptly named Dead Sea, there was an even more intimidating landscape, formed of nothing but dust, salt, and mud. It was here, in the wake of the burning of the temple in the 1st century AD, that an army of Jewish rebels had made a last doomed stand. But already, long, long previously, the region had borne spectacular witness to the incineration of a sinful people, and to the full, devastating horror of where the angering of God might lead. On the eastern shore of the Dead Sea, where the mud bubbled at its filthiest and most stinking, two mighty cities had once stood, Sodom and Gomorrah. Their inhabitants, so moralists recorded, had been wholly given over to vice, to rape, to sex with people of their own gender, and to breaking wind in public. Provoked beyond endurance by such depravity, the Almighty had duly decreed the obliteration of the two cities. Fire and brimstone had rained down upon them. The smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. Of Sodom and Gomorrah nothing had remained, saving only the odd salt-caked ruin to serve passers-by as an admonition and a terror. The lesson was not entirely bleak, though. On the southern shore of the Dead Sea there stood a church, and inside the church there was a cave. It was said that Abraham's nephew, Lot, graced by a tip-off from some angels, had sheltered here with his family, the only survivors of the annihilation of Sodom. The implication of this, that a righteous man such as Lot might be spared the ruin of a doomed people by fleeing into the wilderness, had not gone unremarked over the centuries. Samaritans were hardly the first refugees to have sought sanctuary beyond the borders of the Promised Land. Back in the days of their own persecution by Rome, Christians had done the selfsame thing. Some of them, even after the conversion of Constantine, had refused to return from the desert to the temptations of everyday life. Among the cliffs beyond Jerusalem, as on the mountains around Antioch or in the desert of Sinai, ascetics had looked to build for themselves a city of God. In the midst of a drear and bandit-haunted wilderness, the monasteries that dotted the eastern flank of Palestine aimed to blaze like bulwarks of paradise. Manned by warriors of God from across the empire, linked by paths that crisscrossed the wilds like the cords of a far-flung net, and buttressed by imposing stonework that gave them the look of fortresses, these lavras, as they were called, served the church in its great battle against the demonic as an awesome first line of defence. Out in the desert, where Christ himself had been tempted by the devil, only the spiritual elite could hope to prosper. The weak fell away. The strong grew even stronger. This was why, in the Holy Land, it was the monks who constituted the shock troops of orthodoxy. Forged in the blast furnace of the desert, they brought to the practice of their faith a show of fortitude, of discipline, of steel. They, more than anyone, could be relied upon to embrace martyrdom at the hands of Samaritans, to stage public protests against any hint of concession to the Monophysites, to press the imperial authorities to hold their nerve in the battle against every last enemy of God. Vital tasks anywhere, but in the Holy Land, especially so. Arm yourselves against heresies, against Jews, against Samaritans, against pagans. So had urged Cyril, a golden-tongued bishop of Jerusalem back in the 1st century of the city's existence as a Christian capital, warning converts there of the peculiar charge that God had laid upon their shoulders. Many are your enemies. Be sure you have ammunition. 2 centuries later, the marks of just how successful Cyril's call to arms had been were everywhere to be seen, stamped on the face of the Holy Land. On the hill above Tiberias, on the summit of Mount Gerizim, in the mouldering shells of abandoned temples. There were, however, few visible traces of perhaps the most telling victory of all. Cyril, in the advice offered to his converts, had lingered on one particularly mortal threat. "If a book is not read in a church, then do not read it yourself, even alone." Specifically, he had cautioned against those seeming scriptures that bore the title of gospel, but were false and full of deceit. Such a warning, of course, would have been valid anywhere, but in the Holy Land especially so. Not every Christian who flocked there was necessarily orthodox, after all. A yearning to walk in the footsteps of Christ did not necessarily imply obedience to the Council of Nicaea. There were grounds for alarm, as well as self-satisfaction, in the cosmopolitan character of the Holy Land. Nowhere else in the world, as Cyril had well appreciated, were banned gospels, banned doctrines, banned identities likelier to be available. Moreover, immigrants were not the only heretics to be found in Palestine. Camped out on the frontier between Christianity and Judaism, and what had become, since the Council of Nicaea, an ever more brutally patrolled no-man's land, there lingered still a few obdurate squatters. Jews who honoured Christ as a just man, and Christians who yearned to see the temple restored. How were these to be categorised? "As pestiferous impostors," came the ringing answer of the Church. "For though they pretend to be both Jews and Christians, yet they are neither." Add to this unsettling mix the Samaritans, who were darkly suspected of having fostered the swarming plague of Gnostics, and it was no wonder that bishops such as Cyril regarded the melting pot of faiths to be found in Palestine as so potentially toxic. To scholars of his generation, the threat from heresy in the Holy Land seemed as terrifying as ever. After all, if a Jew could be a Christian, and a Christian a Jew, then who was to say what further monstrous fusions of belief might be possible? Answers to that, in the manuscript-littered libraries of the Holy Land, were certainly still there for those with eyes to see. Jerome, ever the assiduous bookworm, had reported in a tone of mingled horror and fascination his perusal of a gospel written in Hebrew that contained the noxious teachings of a sect called the Nazareans. These heretics, who had the nerve to claim descent from the original Jewish church that had existed prior to the arrival of Paul upon the scene, taught something truly shocking: that the Holy Spirit was not only female, but the heavenly mother of Christ. Nor was that the worst, by any means. To true connoisseurs of heresy, the Nazareans ranked as mere beginners. The Church's leading specialist in such matters, a bishop from Cyprus by the name of Epiphanius, had identified an infinitely more sinister attempt to poison the faithful with the toxin of Jewishness. Explaining to his shocked readers the existence of Christians who denied the Trinity and held Jesus to have been merely a man who obeyed the law of Moses and who turned in the direction of Jerusalem when they performed their daily prayers, the learned bishop had fingered a teacher called Abion, a veritable monster, so Epiphanius claimed, who had blended Judaism with the repulsiveness of the Samaritans, not to mention a whole host of other heresies too. In such a figure, then, could be caught the ultimate glimpse of a world in which Christians and Jews forgot their proper place, a world in which there was nothing to stop some innovative heretic from taking an item of preaching from every sect and patterning himself after them all. No wonder, then, that bishops such as Cyril and Epiphanius, backed up by the militant fervour of the province's monks and the muscle of the imperial Roman state, should have laboured long and hard to impose an orthodox model of Christianity on the Holy Land. No wonder either that the Jews, menaced as they were by such a project, should have regarded with an increasingly suspicious hatred those of their number who still thought to call upon the name of Christ. People such as the Nazareans or the Ebionites, squeezed from both sides, duly found themselves pushed ever deeper into the shadows. There was nothing for them to do, in the battleground for rival faiths that Palestine had become, save to retreat into ever deeper oblivion. No man's land, in the final reckoning, had proved an impossible place to be. Certainly, by the time of Justinian, no bishop thought to bother himself with the Ebionites, nor any rabbi either. Their doctrines and their doings had become things so spectral as to have been almost entirely forgotten. The Christians and the Jews of Palestine, cordially, though they might detest one another, could at least agree on one thing. Hybrids were beyond the pale. And perhaps literally so. If indeed the Ebionites and their like did manage to cling on to a precarious existence within the Christian Empire, then it could only ever have been on the margins, on the Golan Heights above Galilee, perhaps, or in outposts planted deep in the desert. To those defined by the Church as heretics, as to refugees from Samaria, it was no longer their traditional heartlands that held out the surest prospects of survival, but rather the wilderness. The result was a curious irony. For even as the frontier between Palestine and the desert was being colonized by the shock troops of Christian orthodoxy, by monks and ascetics, so also did it bear a certain ghostly witness to the world as it had been before the establishment of Christianity, when the borders between rival faiths had been less clear-cut, more vociferous. Just as the massive stonework of a lavra, a desert monastery, proclaimed the truth of the new, so also were there to be glimpsed, faint perhaps, but present all the same for those inspired to track them down, the broken traces of a far more ancient order. In the wilds between Palestine and Sinai, for instance, there stood shrines raised by tribesmen who still worshipped a whole multitude of gods. Polytheists, as they were contemptuously termed. Meanwhile, in the cliffs above the Dead Sea, it was not unheard of for mysterious scrolls to be excavated from chambers in the middle of the mountain with many books in them, scrolls that might prove to contain versions of the Jewish scriptures, but fabulously ancient, and with strange and variant readings. Clearly, then, amid the dryness of the sands, prospects for the survival of otherwise long-forgotten manuscripts were not altogether hopeless, and perhaps, that being so, the same was true of long-obsolete doctrines, too. Out in the wilderness, after all, beyond the reach of the Christian Empire and the monks who had colonized its periphery, there was no one greatly to care which gods people might worship, nor which books they might read, nor which obsolete beliefs they might hug to themselves. Out in the wilderness, there was no one to patrol the frontiers of faiths that elsewhere, once and for all, had put up the barricades. The Wolves of Arabia. Like sand borne on an easterly wind, hints of the strange and aberrant beliefs that simmered in the desert were occasionally still to be found even in the Holy Land itself. Some 20 miles south of Jerusalem, for instance, at a spot set among open fields named Mamre, pagans from beyond the frontiers of Palestine would gather every summer to keep a brilliant feast. The roots of this festival were quite fabulously ancient, for they had, as their focus, an oak that was the oldest tree in the world. Neither Jews nor Christians thought to dispute this sensational pedigree. Both were agreed that the tree was as ancient as creation, and that it had been a favourite of Abraham's to boot. A well dug by the patriarch still stood beside it, and although the oak itself, thanks to the merciless attentions of Christian souvenir hunters, had long since been hacked down to a stump, an unmistakable aura of holiness still attached itself to the mutilated trunk. In the first book of the Bible, it was recorded that Abraham, sitting in the shade of the oak, had played host to three mysterious strangers, who had delivered him the good news that his wife, Sarah, hitherto barren, was to bear him a son. Two of the strangers had then continued on their way, but the third, informing Abraham of his intention to wipe out Sodom, had stood revealed as none other than God himself. Nothing, then, could have been more offensive to Jews and Christians alike than the hosting of a festival at such a spot. And, sure enough, both had made repeated efforts to redeem it from the polluted attentions of the pagans. As far back as the time of Jesus, a Jewish king had raised a large wall around both tree and well, with the aim of staking out the very place, the Makum, where Abraham had stood before the Lord. Some 300 years later, Constantine had gone one better by ordering a church to be constructed directly over the oak. As well he might have done, for Christians were agreed that the three strangers entertained by Abraham could only have been the Trinity, and that Mamre, as a result, had always been a place of pristine sanctity, devoted to the worship of our Saviour. Certainly, in the stern judgment of Constantine, all pagan claims to the site were the merest falsehood and blasphemy. Stripped of all its obscene accumulation of idols and blood-stained altars, the oak stood revealed as what it had been way back in the time of Abraham, a thoroughly Christian tree. The pagans, however, oblivious to this transcendent truth, had persisted in visiting Mamre. More than a century after Constantine had attempted to ban their summer festival, they were still flocking to the sacred oak, where they would sacrifice cockerels, pour wine and throw cakes into Abraham's well, and ostentatiously abstain from sex. Such behaviour, at a time when paganism elsewhere in the Holy Land was being harried and bullied into extinction, required a deal of nerve. Nor was it greatly surprising that most of the festival-goers came from beyond the borders of Palestine. Indeed, that they belonged to a people widely scorned across the Near East as the most superstitious and ignorant in the world, and whose contempt for monarchs and their laws had long been notorious. The Arabs, tribesmen who haunted the interminable wastes that stretched south of the Fertile Crescent, could boast a record of barbarism more venerable than the empires of either Persia or Rome. Dwelling, as they do, in the distant desert, they know neither overseers nor officials. A state of affairs so mind-bogglingly unnatural that even a king of Mesopotamia, back in the distant days when Solomon's temple still stood in Jerusalem, had thought to make a note of it. 1,000 years on, opinions had barely improved. The Arabs appeared as reluctant as ever to put down roots. They were despised, not merely as pagans, but as pagans who lived in tents. To an aristocrat in his palace, as to a peasant in his field, the inveterate shiftlessness of such nomads was both a menace and an affront. That the Arabs, in their disdain for the norms of civilization, were possessed of an almost timeless quality of ferocity, like that of the deserts where they lurked, was widely taken for granted. Less than human, they were something more than beasts. In battle, it was not unknown for them to drink their victims' blood, while even in their love-making, so it was darkly rumoured, they were quite explosively violent, women as well as men. Nervous travellers venturing beyond the limits of cities and farms viewed the half-naked Arabs on their horses or camels as a menace no less deadly than the most ferocious desert predator. For, like rapacious kites, which have only to catch sight of prey from on high to swoop down upon it with outstretched talons, they make off with whatever they can seize. An insult that would no doubt have delighted the Arabs themselves. To be as free and as feared as a bird of prey was, in many ways, everything they most desired. What other peoples condemned as shiftlessness, they prized as liberty. I journeyed with a brown whip, its handle bare of its original thonging, with its lash hanging from its loop. To ride like this, alone with the horizon infinite all around, was to know oneself with a rare and vaunting conviction, the utter opposite of a slave. Wherever Arabs gathered, whether in the shade of an embroidered tent or around a fire beneath the stars, they were sure to sing the praises of wine, slim-waisted women, and warriors who acknowledged no master. The nomads of the desert might have been despised, but they were also feared. When the Persians charged Dahag, the demon king, with having been one of their number, and the Romans condemned them for their slaving and kidnapping as agents of the devil, the Arabs were being paid a form of tribute. Better a bandit than a dependent, after all. Who were the subjects of the Shahanshah or of Caesar to presume otherwise? In truth, though, the Arabs were not quite the lone wolves of their victims' paranoia. Their realm was an unremittingly harsh one, and no man could possibly survive amid the sand, salt flats, and wind-weathered lava beds without others to watch out for him. Even to the hardiest and haughtiest warrior, family was everything. We follow the ways of our forefathers, those who kindled wars and were faithful to the ties of kinship. This resounding brag expressed the very essence of an Arab's identity. Extended networks of relatives blurred seamlessly into tribe. All men who could claim descent, however implausibly, from a single imam, a founding father, were to be reckoned his sons. Bound by a single inheritance of custom and achievement, of sunnah, warriors who might otherwise have torn each other to shreds were enabled to unite without loss of face, and turn on all those neighbouring bands of rivals who might have done the same. The great joy of an Arab's life, even more than the pillaging of caravans or the slaughtering of camels in honour of some ivory-skinned beauty, was to feud violently with another tribe. Much was bound to derive from it. Honour, excitement, maybe even a well or two. That there was an essential pointlessness to such contests, an unvarying and remorseless quality, much like that of the desert itself, did not in any way lessen the enjoyment of those who indulged in them. The great deeds performed by a tribe's ancestors, rehearsed as they were in glowing, if suspiciously interchangeable, verses by its poets, offered its warriors both backdrop and inspiration. Memories of ancient battles, if gilded with sufficient imagination, might serve to dignify even the most squalid scuffle. As a result, among the Arabs, past and present were barely distinguishable. While it might be possible for one particularly recent and stirring episode to serve the tribe who commemorated it as a line drawn in the otherwise interminable sands of time, all it needed was for some new victory to be won, some new livestock or women to be seized, and the line would promptly be erased and quite forgotten. Certainly, the law that every tribe lovingly preserved about itself was concerned with nothing so tedious as chronology. It was known quite simply as ayam, days. Yet in truth, even in the remotest stretches of the desert, the Arabs were never wholly immune to the tug of great events in the world beyond. The ebb and flow of great power politics had even, on occasion, come to alter their entire way of living. Time was, for instance, when Arab merchants had been famously sweet-smelling, for frankincense, an aromatic spice that had once been burned in near-industrial quantities on pagan altars, was cultivated exclusively in Himyar, on the southernmost tip of their peninsula. Back in the age of Solomon, the queen of this incense-growing land, Sheba, as it had then been known, had visited the great king in Jerusalem, trailing perfumed clouds of glory in her wake, while more recently, among the Romans, its inhabitants had been famed as the happiest and most prosperous of men. All that, however, had changed with the toppling of the pagan gods. Christ demanded no incense. The trade between Rome and the frankincense growers of Himyar had duly withered, The Arabs, no longer renowned for their perfumes, became notorious instead for their reek of leather and camel shit. Caravans might still toil across the desert, but those who rode alongside them now tended to play the demeaning and insecure role of middlemen. That it was worth the while of camels freighted with all the luxuries of India, pepper, gemstones, and castrated page boys, to plod their way across the sands towards Palestine and Syria, owed everything to the whims of distant emperors, to the calculations of bureaucrats. A treaty renegotiated here, a customs post closed down there, and everything would abruptly change. Merchants, camel drivers, bandits, all might find themselves ruined overnight. Prey as they were to such insecurity, there had always been some Arab tribes eager to set their fortunes on a firmer footing. Some, like the Nabataeans, a people who occupied the southern fringes of Palestine, had exploited their position between the trade routes of the desert and the Mediterranean to create a fabulously wealthy commercial hub, centred on their pink-hued capital of Petra. Others, looking to take a shortcut to power, had aimed to infiltrate the cities of other peoples and then to seize their commanding heights, a policy of playing cuckoo in the nest that explained why the kings of Edessa had been of Arab descent. Nevertheless, the independence of such states, menaced as it was by the domineering shadow of Rome, had always been a rickety thing. As early as AD 106, the kingdom of Nabatea had been gobbled up entire and reconstituted as the province of Arabia, and although Edessa held out against formal assimilation into the empire for a further 150 years, it had never been left in any doubt as to its thoroughly subordinate status. Riches and sophistication, these, it appeared, might certainly be obtained by the Arabs. The price, however, was a high one, the loss of honour, of liberty, of all that made an Arab. How, then, was this awkward circle to be squared? In 270, just a few decades after the annexation of Edessa, there had arrived a spectacular straw on the wind. Zenobia, the queen of an oasis city named Palmyra, midway between Antioch and Ctesiphon, had made a pitch for nothing less than the whole of the Roman Near East. Syria, Egypt, and much of Asia Minor all fell to the sudden onslaught of her armies. Granted, her moment in the sun was fleeting. Defeated outside Antioch in 272, she was taken to Rome and paraded as a living trophy, while her desert capital was abandoned to slow decay and oblivion. The true significance of her comet-like blaze, however, had lain less in its trajectory than in the circumstances that had made it possible. Zenobia's own defeat and humiliation had been paralleled, 12 years previously, by the fate of the Emperor Valerian. His captor, of course, had been a rival monarch, the lord of a dominion no less intimidatingly formidable than Rome's, the recently established empire of Iran Shah. By using a Caesar as his mounting block, Shapur had proclaimed, in terms that no Roman emperor would ever again be able to discount, the arrival of an authentic equal upon the global scene. For the Arabs, too, the implications of the rise to greatness of the House of Sasan had been momentous. The deserts where they lived had abruptly come to constitute the frontier not of one superpower, but of two. Situated as they now were on the world's deadliest geopolitical fault line, they would never again be able to claim even the most precarious neutrality. Yet the deadly grinding of the twin tectonic plates of Rome and Iran Shah, even as it crushed forever the independence of such cities as Edessa and Palmyra, spelled opportunity as well as calamity for upwardly mobile Arabs. In a war zone, after all, what more precious commodity than bands of seasoned warriors? Rome and Persia alike both had urgent need of swords. The Arabs found themselves ideally placed to hawk their services to the highest bidder. To the Romans, of course, there was nothing remotely novel about the employment of barbarians. As along the Rhine, prior to the collapse of the Western Empire, so along the borders of Syria and Palestine, the imperial authorities were well versed in the hiring of tribes as confederates, as foederati. Even prior to the emergence of the Persian threat, back in the 2nd century AD, the Romans had successfully bribed and cajoled a number of tribes into serving as a desert police force, and the example of this confederation, the Talmud, would long be commemorated by Arab poets. Understandably so, perhaps, for what it had served to demonstrate was that even the proudly and inveterately fractious tribes of the desert might, under certain circumstances, be forged into a shirkat, a partnership. Such a lesson, against the backdrop of escalating superpower confrontation, had certainly not gone unnoted by ambitious chieftains. Horizons had steadily expanded, wild fantasies taken wing. In 328, for instance, one Arab warlord had been buried beneath a tombstone that grandiloquently proclaimed him to have been King of all the Arabs. A title no less bogus than it was unprecedented, but most suggestive all the same. As Rome and Iran Shah competed ever more vigorously for the services of the desert tribes, so the potential pickings on offer for the tribesmen themselves had indeed grown steadily more lucrative. Although the confederation of the Talmud had long since imploded, having been struck down in sensational fashion, so Arab law claimed, by a thunderbolt, other foederati had fast emerged to take its place. It's telling that Roman authors, from the 4th century onwards, began to use a new word to designate the Arabs, one that seems ultimately to have derived from shirkat, Saracens. Although the Romans themselves appear to have been wholly ignorant of the original meaning, and although the stereotype they had of the Saracens remained the reassuringly traditional one of nomads, bandits, and savages, the use they made of the new name did nevertheless hint at a new and emerging order. In the yawning deserts between Palestine and Mesopotamia, Arab tribesmen were no longer operating merely on a freelance basis. While they still indulged in their traditional pastimes, slaving, cattle rustling, raiding caravans and frontier posts, they increasingly did so as agents of the rival superpowers. To the Arabs on both sides, so the twitchy inhabitants of the Fertile Crescent began to observe, war between Persia and Rome is a source of very great profit indeed. Nowhere better illustrated this than a town famed throughout Arabia as the epitome of power and glamour. Hira stood only a few miles south of Sura, on the southern flank of Mesopotamia, but it might as well have been a world away from the lecture halls of the rabbis. Situated in an oasis between the Euphrates and the desert, it served in every sense as a place of hybrids. Although a linchpin of Sasanian defences, the great bulwark that blocked access from the south to Ctesiphon, it was commanded not by a Persian, but by an Arab. The Banu Lachm, Lachm's sons, had long been based in the region, where they had enjoyed a profitable existence as mercenaries in the service of the Shahanshah. Even under Peroz, despite all the tempting convulsions of his reign, they had remained loyal to the Persian crown. The decision had been a thoroughly calculating one, and in due course it had reaped spectacular reward. Kavad, ever innovative, had graced the Lachmids with an unprecedented promotion when, shortly after the outbreak of war with Rome in 502, he appointed their youthful and brutally able chieftain, Mundir, to rule as king over all the scattered Arab tribes that were then confederated to Iran Shah. Hira, a sprawl of settlements that alternated mud-brick walls with encampments, gardens with desert scrub, and wheat fields with herds of camels, provided the Lachmid chieftain with the perfect showcase for this trend-setting fusion of royalty and banditry. Not for nothing, in the Lachmid's own language, did the city's name mean camp. Mundhir, who spent his time there living alternately in a palace and a tent, aimed to combine the best of Persian sophistication with the noblest traditions of his own people. Profits from plunder were spent not only on beefing up his offensive capabilities, but on the manifold glories and pleasures of life as an Arab. From camel archers to poets, brigands to dancing girls, Hira boasted them all. Even the odd scribe was to be found there, for the city, so it was plausibly claimed, was where the Arabs had first learned to put their language into writing. Unsurprisingly, it attracted a steady stream of migrants from across the desert, all hungry for the patronage that Mundhir could so swaggeringly provide. A day and a night at Hira, it was said, are better than a whole year of medicine. No single place in the Roman sphere of influence could quite rival the dazzle of this appeal. That this was so, however, reflected not any lack of contacts between the Arabs and Rome, but rather their sheer range and antiquity. Along the western fringes of the desert, no particular exoticism attached itself to the notion that the realms of the nomad and the city might be blended. The Nabataeans, and many other tribes too, had been citizens of Rome for centuries. One of their number had even risen to become Caesar. Philip, the same emperor who had presided over the capital's millennial celebrations, had hailed from a city on the frontier, to the east of the Sea of Galilee, and been derisively nicknamed the Arab. The existence of settlements such as Philip's hometown, right on the margins of the desert, were evidence enough of the wholehearted relish with which the Arabs, no less than any other people of the empire, might embrace the Pax Romana and settle down. Nowhere, however, was this more apparent than in the Negev, the arid wilderness that stretched between the Sinai and Petra, and where even as Mundhir was establishing his regime in Hira, vines and olives were being conjured from the sand. Take one of the paved roads, the strata, that crisscrossed the region, and in due course an entire city would materialize on the horizon, rising like a mirage above the desolation, a paradise of farmland, stone houses and baths. A miracle? Hardly. It was only through the most back-breaking labour that the ceaseless battle against the sands could hope to be won, only with the most exhaustive maintenance of cisterns, aqueducts and dams. Yet the cities of the Negev, for all that the water might sometimes taste brackish and the scrub-flecked desert stretch away barren in every direction, did truly serve as outposts of the wider world beyond. Even in the most remote, an isolated settlement by the name of Nisana that served pilgrims on the road to Sinai as a final way stop, there were bureaucrats who wrote in Greek and would-be lawyers who studied Latin. More than 2 centuries after Constantine had filched the Palladium for his new capital, there was even a copy of the Aeneid in the local library. In Nisana, time as well as distance might be dissolved, for the myths of which Virgil had sung were older by far than himself, older even than Rome. On frayed papyri, in the depths of a lonely desert, the halls of Mount Olympus, where the gods of Greece had reclined on exquisite couches, partnered by ox-eyed goddesses and served wine by eternally beautiful youths, still preserved a spectral hold. Given enough time, then, it seemed that even the wolves of Arabia might be domesticated into lawyers or literary critics. Certainly, from the perspective of such cities as Nisana, where the prodigious array of hydraulic works was accompanied by a quite striking absence of fortifications, it did genuinely appear as though the desert had been tamed. A comforting reassurance, perhaps, except that, in truth, the imperial authorities had no desire to see every last Saracen defanged. Along the limits of the empire, where Mundhir's Lachmids were conducting ever more audacious raids, there was an urgent need for attack dogs of their own. Many a Roman base might boast an encampment of Saracens, a Hira. Other concentrations of Arab, Foederati, entire cities of tents, thronged with a shifting population of warriors, horses and camels, lay under the command of tribal chieftains rather than Roman officers. The reign of Justinian would see the largest of these, a teeming settlement east of the Golan Heights called Jabiya, become to Syria and Palestine what Hira was to Ctesiphon, a key defensive stronghold. The tribesmen who lived there, the Banu Ghassan, were recognizably the mirror image of the Lakhmids. For the sons of Ghassan combined a ferocious loyalty to their imperial patrons with a haughty Arab chauvinism. Certainly, the Latin spoken in Jabiya owed little to the study of Virgil. The phrases familiar to the Arabs of the frontier derived not from poets, but from the army. Over the course of the previous centuries, the sheer awesome immensity of Rome's military apparatus had stamped itself indelibly upon the language spoken by the Foederati. So it was, for instance, that the camps of the frontier system, the castra, had provided the Arabs with their own word for fortress, khasa. So it was, too, that the strata, the paved roads built by Roman military engineers to link each camp along the frontier, had bequeathed their name to the entire desert south of Palmyra. Indeed, such was their impact upon the Foederati that sirat, the form that the original Latin word had come to take in Arabic, could signify almost any kind of path. The strata, those great gashes of gravel and stone scored in straight lines across even the most unforgiving of landscapes, had become for the Arabs the very quintessence of a highway. Not that they themselves, of course, had much need of paving stones. What would their record of banditry have been, after all, without a talent for going off-road? In early 529, when Mundhir suddenly appeared in northern Syria, looting and burning almost to the walls of Antioch, the leaden-footed response of the provincial authorities was little different to that of some hapless farmer finding his sheep pen being cleaned out. For with such speed did he move, and with such ruthless calculation, that invariably he would be gone with his loot before the military authorities could even discover what was going on, let alone arrive to stop it. Fire of this order could only hope to be fought with fire, and Justinian knew it. A few months after Mundhir's rampage through Syria, he crowned an Arab all of his own. His choice, predictably enough, had fallen upon the chieftain of the Banu Ghassan, a youthful but already seasoned warlord by the name of Al-Harith, or, as he was known by his patrons, Aritas. Summoned from Jibaya to Constantinople, the Ghassanid prince was splendidly arrayed in the white silken cloak of Roman monarchy and a bejewelled coronet. His promotion bore witness to Justinian's customary eye for talent. Aritas, no less than Mundhir, was a man of boldness, charisma, and vision. What was more, he positively revelled in a blood feud. Before long, the two warlords' struggle had come to possess its own furious and deadly rhythm, as relentless as it was personal. To no one's great surprise, the signing in 532 of a treaty between Justinian and Khusro, for all its ambition to establish an eternal peace between the two empires, did little to dampen the mutual hatred of their respective Arab clients. Ghassanid and Lakhmid, both, across the desert sands, continued to eyeball each other. Nor was it merely their political loyalties, or even their personal vanities, that rendered their mutual hatred so unblinking. Neither Aretas nor Mundhir had any doubts that they were engaged in a conflict that was more than earthly. If Christians saw in the desert the ultimate arena, where athletes of God might test themselves to the limits of their endurance against entire armies of demonic adversaries, then it certainly needed no baptism for an Arab to recognize in it a realm alive with spirits. Many of these, whether born on a scorching wind or haunting a bone-littered salt flat, were malevolent in the extreme. But not all were, by any means. Some, such as the owls that rose from the heads of men slain in battle, served as the guardians of individual warriors, while others stood watch over particular places. The favour of the divine might be experienced wherever there was water, or shade, or merely a landscape of startling beauty. The Arabs had little need of idols, let alone temples, to alert those who approached a god of his presence. Focus of their awe was much more likely to be a natural feature, if not a tree, as at Mamre, then a spring, or a mountain peak, or a rock. Always, however, there was only the one certain measure of holiness. A god could be reckoned no god who did not on occasion keep his sanctuary free of violence. At certain times, in certain places, tribes who might otherwise have slaughtered one another with ferocious abandon would assemble upon grounds staked out as hallowed, haram, and there join in festivities quite as joyous and peaceable as those staged every summer at Mamre. Of the Arabs' major shrine, which lay surrounded by palm trees somewhere in the desert south of Palestine, and where the local people were reported to gather twice a year for a whole month or more at a time, it was rumoured that even the wild beasts live in peace with men and among themselves. Not, however, that pacifism was necessarily on the agenda the whole year round. The gods of the desert, away from their shrines, rarely objected to bloodshed. On occasion, they might positively demand it. At Hira, for instance, there stood two stones sacred to a god named Dushara, which his worshippers would regularly make sticky with gore. A second deity, Al-Uzza, the mighty queen, was graced with an even more spectacular draught of blood, when, in 527, Mundhir sacrificed no fewer than 400 Christian virgins in her honour. Such a goddess, one able to consecrate the soil of the Lakhmid capital as haram, while simultaneously sponsoring the most flamboyant atrocities, could hardly have been better suited to the warlord's needs. Yet there remains something strangely pallid about her, and Dushara too, and all the various gods of the desert. Many, to their worshippers, were little more than names. Loyalty, as a result, was rarely a feature of Arab devotions. A deity who failed a tribe in battle, or neglected to keep it in food, or scared away the camels, would be dumped without a moment's hesitation. Many were the oases where there stood altars, old in years, bearing inscriptions in ancient letters of unknown tongues, raised to gods whose very names had been forgotten. Temples would cheerfully be used to pen goats. To Christian scholars, whose dread of demons such as Artemis was often a form of reluctant tribute paid to their inherent glamour, the Arabs' gods seemed reassuringly dull. Even attempts to condemn them risked making them more interesting than they were. When Epiphanius, the same energetic cataloguer of heresies who had condemned the Ebionites, turned his beady eye on Dushara, he reported that the god's worshippers, in a blasphemous parody of Christian belief, believed the deity to have been born of a virgin, a Ka'iba. The bishop, however, had misheard. Dushara was not a god of a Ka'iba, but of a Ka'ba, a cube. The allusion was to the stone, black and uncarved, that the Nabataeans worshipped as an incarnation of the god, somewhere in a shrine to the south of the Dead Sea. Dushara certainly had nothing so sophisticated as a virgin mother. Meanwhile, many Arabs were turning to the worship of a god who did. Nabataean cities had grown crowded with churches, and even in the wilds of the desert, beyond the reach of either emperor or bishop, whole tribes were turning to Christ. There was often a fair degree of opportunism in this, for it was well known that the Romans would only ever bestow their patronage upon Arabs who ranked as fellow Christians. Yet the Ghassanids, and Aretas especially, were the decided opposite of lukewarm.